Good morning. 9 o'clock, time to begin our study of Ezra and Esther. We are now studying the book of Esther, and we're in the first chapter of Esther. We'll be picking up in a moment with our discussion of verses 10 through 12, which we read at the end of class last week. Let me remind everyone that audio copies of these lessons, as well as any handouts we have, are available on the internet at studyezra.com. studyezra.com. And in fact, today there is a handout. If you didn't get one, they're in the back. And it shows what some of the places in the book of Esther look like today. And you could go and see them if you were brave enough to go to Iran. But if you're not, like I'm not, you can look at them on this handout. It's a lot safer. And on the right, on the left rather, it talks a little bit about what these things are and how they fit in with the events in the book of Esther. Let's begin our class with a prayer. Our dear Father in heaven, we're thankful for this, another beautiful day that you've given us, a day in which we can come and study your word, Father, learn more about you and worship you. Father, we're thankful for this wonderful book of Esther and for all that it teaches us about you and about your providence and about your care and your love for your people. And Father, our prayer is that as we study this book, we will learn and understand more about you, and that as we make decisions in our own lives, we will always try to make decisions that are in accordance with your will so that you can use us as you would to further your kingdom. And Father, we pray all of these things in the name of our King, our Lord, our Savior, Jesus Christ. We pray these things in his name. Amen. As I mentioned, we were discussing verses 10 through 12 of Esther chapter 1 at the end of class last week, and we were looking at the motivations as to why the people were doing the things that they did, and particularly we were looking at Vashti. We were asking the question, why did she refuse to appear before the king? What was her motivation? Why did she do that? And right at the end of class, I said, well, let's step back and take a broader view of the subject, and let's make a broader question, and that is, why aren't we given her motivation? Why is the Bible silent on that, what we might think of as a key question? Anyone reading chapter 1, when they get to this point, is naturally going to be puzzled by what Vashti does. And they're going to wonder, why did she do that? Anybody reading the text is going to have that question. Why doesn't the Bible tell us? Obviously, it's intentional. Obviously, there's a purpose for it. Why? Why does the Bible not tell us? The book of Esther certainly provides motivations elsewhere for others. We'll see them as we go through the text. Why not here? Well, I think the answer goes back to something else I said last week, and that is the book of Esther is a textbook on divine providence. The book of Esther is a textbook on divine providence. The book of Esther shows us how God's providence works. And what we find is that God's providence works in part through human behavior, and human decisions. And we see that here. In fact, what we see here is that that behavior can come from the most ambiguous and the most confused of motives. Even motives we don't even know what they are. What we're seeing is the behavior, not the reasoning behind the behavior. One seemingly insignificant event leads to another in the opening chapters of Esther. And in that mysterious chain of human events that we're seeing here in the opening chapter, the promise of the covenant made long ago is upheld and is fulfilled and is furthered by God. It's telling that the book of Esther does not begin with Mordecai. It does not begin with Esther. It does not begin by retelling the history of the Jews. It begins instead with the pagan Persian king Xerxes, who neither knew nor worshiped God. A completely pagan king decides for worldly reasons to give a banquet. And on the last day of that banquet, he decides to treat the men of his empire to a look at his queen. So he summons her. And then she decides not to come. He decides. And with that chain of decisions, there begins a chain of events that's set in motion, that takes on a life of its own, doesn't it? Why? Because God uses that chain of events. He uses those decisions from Vashti and from Xerxes to bring about good things for his people, for the Jews. And we see that happening here in the book of Esther. Why aren't we told their motivations? Because Vashti's motivations are irrelevant. Because Xerxes' motivations are irrelevant. Was Vashti courageous? Was Vashti modest? Was the king cruel? It matters not. God would use their decisions, He would use their actions to bring about good things for His people. The events in the book of Esther, I think, provide a living example of the promise of Romans 8:28. And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God and to them who are called according to His purpose. I think we see that working in the book of Esther as God is using these decisions and these actions to bring about good things for His people. As for Vashti, whatever her motivation, her refusal does certainly seem to have been courageous. Some might say foolhardy. But she paid the price for that courage. She defied the king. She defied her husband. For whatever reason, we're not told she was willing to give up her status and her power for this, because she did refuse the most powerful person. She must have known there would be consequences. Was it to preserve her modesty, as we often think? Perhaps. We just don't know. We are going to see another courageous action by another queen in the chapter 5 of the book of Esther. And of course, that will be Esther herself. And when we get there, we're again going to be asking, what was her motivation? Now, I think we see a very subtle message in these verses, verses 10 through 12. And that is that this all-powerful, mighty king, Xerxes, was not in charge here. He obviously was not quite all that powerful. He's not getting what he wants here. And I think what we see here in this book of Esther, very early, in just the first few verses, is an answer to the questions we're going to see throughout the book of Esther. And that is, who is really in charge? And who should be obeyed? And at what cost? These verses are doing more than just providing an explanation for why Esther will later come onto the scene in chapter 2. These verses are showing us a glimpse of the central question in this book, and that is, who is in charge? Who is really in charge? Could it be that the one who is really in charge here is not even named in the book of Esther? Because we've already seen that God is not named in the book of Esther. Verse 12 tells us that King Xerxes became enraged. Enraged. The one reason for that great wrath, no doubt, is that this refusal happened in front of his nobles, in front of his princes. He needed these men to obey his commands when he went to war against Greece. But in his own palace, he couldn't even get his own wife to obey his commands. We see in these opening verses the inner weakness of King Xerxes, who outwardly was the most powerful man on earth. Now, one reason Vashti's decision, I said a moment ago, was courageous, or maybe foolhardy, but one reason it did take courage was that she knew what kind of man this was. She knew Xerxes. She knew what kind of person he was. And we have a lot of extra-biblical, historical evidence that Xerxes was completely unstable. He was completely unhinged, not the least of which involves his punishment of the ocean. That strange event is described in a text, a 1913 text by Ellison Horn. Let me read you what happened. And as I read this, keep in mind, this is about Xerxes. This is about the person that Vashti insulted in front of all of his nobles and princes. Darius was succeeded by his son Xerxes, under whom the war with Greece was carried to a disastrous climax. Xerxes was accounted the handsomest man of his time, but proved also the most feeble. He was as idle and foolish as his father had been active and wise. Inexperienced in warfare, Xerxes planned an expedition of numbers so vast that he expected them completely to overwhelm the rebellious Greeks. It was not easy for a Persian army to travel all the way to far-off Greece, and Xerxes was weary of the march before it even began. When at length his forces reached the strait which separates Asia from Europe, a bridge of ships was built from shore to shore. A storm swept this away, and Xerxes showed his petty wrath by commanding his soldiers to give the sea 300 lashes with whips, as if it had been a human slave. He also had a set of fetters thrown into the water as a symbol of its bondage to him. After this punishment, though possibly not because of it, the sea behaved better, and the bridge of ships held firm, and Xerxes entered Europe. Herodotus tells us that Xerxes once beheaded the men building a bridge on that same campaign. Why? Because a storm delayed its completion. So he beheaded everybody building it. This was the person Vashti decided to openly defy and embarrass. And she knew him better than anybody. You know, as I mentioned in our introduction, we often view Vashti as noble and heroic. Maybe she was. We don't know. But certainly that's not the case with many other commentaries. Most ancient and Jewish, even, Christian sources, Jewish and even Christian, early Christian views of it, villainize Vashti. Villainize her as a wicked and rebellious woman. Why? Because she refused to obey her husband. Even Martin Luther used Vashti as a negative example in his writing about divorce when he urged husbands in some situations to, quote, take an Esther and let Vashti go. Well, we're going to have a lot more to say about divorce when we get back to Ezra, because Ezra is going to deal with that topic when we get back there. But as we've said before, no one knows Vashti's motivations. No one knows if she really was a mistress. I think she likely was. And if that's the case, Herodotus tells us Amestris was a very evil person. Verses 13 through 15. Then the king said to the wise man, which knew the times, for so was the king's manner toward all that knew law and judgment. And the next unto him was Karshina, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Mersana, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media, which saw the king's face and which sat the first in the kingdom. What shall we do unto the queen Vashti according to the law, because she hath not performed the commandment of the king Ahasuerus by the chamberlains? Well, in verses 13 through 15, the king discusses what's happened with his counselors. It was customary for a Persian king to have counselors like this. It was also customary for a Persian king to have them killed when they didn't tell him what he wanted to hear. Darius II had done that. Cambyses had done that. Now, these counselors were said, they said, saw the king's face. What that means is that they had special access to the king. Herodotus described it this way: any of the seven may enter the palace unannounced, except when the king was in bed with a woman. That's how Herodotus described it. They had access to the king. They saw the king's face. These seven were the highest in the kingdom. They were right next to the king. It says they sat first in the kingdom, is what the text here tells us. And that was likely not just figurative. I think that was literal, because we see them right here sitting next to the king at the banquet. They're right next to the king. Ezra chapter 7, verse 14, when we get back there, is also going to talk about the king's seven counselors. So that's a very important historical fact that Esther and Ezra and the extra-biblical histories all agree on: seven counselors next to the king. Verse 13 says these counselors knew the times. What that means is they knew astrology, and they knew other forms of divination. And again, I think we have the question here in verse 13 that's going to underlie the entire text. Who is really in charge? Who is really in charge? Is it fate? Is it luck? Is what happened to us determined by the stars? Or perhaps is there a greater power involved, the one who made the stars, but who is not mentioned by name in this book? What can we say about the names in verse 14? Karshina, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Mersana, Memucan. Well, one of them has a speaking role in verse 16, but the others do not. They're never mentioned again. They don't have any speaking roles. Why are we given their names? Well, we also weren't given the names of the eunuchs in verse 10. Well, first and foremost, as we said about verse 10, I think giving the names really gives us a firm foundation for the historical nature of this text. I mean, we've got details. This isn't someone just making this up. We got the names, the dates, the places. This is a detailed historical narrative. One of the names, Karshina, has been found in one of the fortification tablets that was dug up. So, you know, we at least know there was someone there by that name that was from extra-biblical evidence. But there may be another reason why they're mentioned. All these names are Persian. They're all Persian. And one commentary suggested that this the sound of these foreign Persian names to the Jews, they would have had a ludicrous sound to Hebrew ears, they said. And just giving the names, they said to a Hebrew, it would have just given the impression of a dumb pagan chorus advising the king. And if that's true, it's interesting because we're going to start seeing some humor and some mockery and ridicule in this book about the pagans and about the Persians, and certainly about the so-called great King Xerxes as the chapter continues. This may be kind of a foretaste of this, to kind of give these names. They were true historical names, and apparently they would have sounded ludicrous to Hebrew ears, according to that commentary. In verse 15, the king asked his wise counselors, "What should I do about rebellious Queen Vashti?" Verses 16 through 18. And Memucan answered before the king and the princes, "Vashti the queen hath not done wrong to the king only, but also to all the princes and to all the people that are in the provinces of the king Ahasuerus. For this deed of the queen shall come abroad unto all women, so that they shall despise their husbands in their eyes when it shall be reported. The king Ahasuerus commanded Vashti the queen to be brought in before him, but she came not. Likewise shall the ladies of Persia and Media say this day unto all the king's princes which have heard of the deed of the queen. Thus shall there arise too much contempt and wrath." Well, verses 16 through 18 describe the seriousness of Vashti's offense against the king, at least in the eyes of his advisors, Memucan, one of the seven close advisors. He explains that this is not just an offense against the king, not at all. This is an offense against all husbands everywhere. When the word gets out about what Vashti has done, it's going to cause other wives to despise their husbands in their eyes, the text says. Well, this answer was really very clever when you think about it. I mean, this guy wasn't called a wise man for nothing, apparently. Why was it so clever? Well, it relieved the king from a charge that he was just acting on his own personal animosity or capriciousness. And instead, now he's acting on behalf of husbands everywhere. What could be more noble for the good King Xerxes, right? It's not just me. I'm working for the kingdom. I'm working for husbands everywhere. Memucan has elevated the king's marital problem to a national crisis. And you know, the rabbis I've mentioned very often added a little bit to the text to kind of give a little more explanation for what they thought might have been going on. And according to rabbinic tradition, Memucan himself was having problems with his own disobedient wife at home, so he was using this as an opportunity to bring her into line. That's what the rabbis said. Of course, no evidence in the text for that. Well, what happens next? Verse 19. "If it please the king, let there go a royal commandment from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, that it be not altered, that Vashti come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal estate unto another that is better than she. And when the king's decree which he shall make shall be published throughout all his empire, for it is great, all the wives shall give to their husbands honor, both to great and small. And the saying pleased the king and the princes, and the king did according to the word of Memucan. For he sent letters into all the king's provinces, into every province according to the writing thereof, and to every people after their language, that every man should bear in his own house, shall bear rule in his own house, and that it should be published according to the language of every people." Well, verses 19 through 22 give us the queen's punishment, and they give us the king's decree. For the punishment, Vashti would lose her royal position and never again be allowed to come before the king, before this king. If this is Amestris, she would later come before another king, her son, Artaxerxes, when he came into power, but never again before King Xerxes. Verse 19 says that in her place would be put someone who is better than she. And of course, that's leading us up to who we know will soon take her place. Notice that for the first time in this book, Queen Vashti is referred to in verse 19 simply as Vashti. She has experienced a big reversal, a big reversal. The irrevocability of the king's command, it's mentioned there in verse 19. We talked about it in our introduction. It's also mentioned, of course, in Daniel chapter 6, where Darius, not Darius the Great, but another person named Darius, was manipulated into forbidding anyone to pray, and we remember what happened there. Many critics, as we've said, complain that there's no evidence for such things outside the Bible. And in fact, they sometimes complain that it doesn't really even make sense. Here's what one commentary said. "It's hard to conceive of a legal system which does not allow for emendation of its laws. Further, there is no attestation of such an idea in any Persian source, nor is there any mention of it in Greek sources. Well, I think he's wrong on all three counts. That commentary suggests, well, we need to change the text here, and instead of repealed, we say it can't be transgressed, and what they're really saying later is that we really can't undo this law because it's already started and it's just impractical. That's not what the text says. The text says it can't be altered. The text says it's irrevocable, and certainly that's what we saw back in Daniel chapter 6. So we're not going to solve this problem, as some like to do, by just rewriting the text. But, you know, is it really a problem? We saw earlier in the introduction that Herodotus, a section I read to you from Herodotus, talked about King Xerxes himself being compelled by his own law. That was the word Herodotus used, compelled. Well, doesn't that tell us that Xerxes could not alter it? If he's compelled by it, that he couldn't change it? That's from Herodotus. And we've already also saw in Ezra chapter 4, verse 21, I think a very important example. Because in that example, you'll recall that royal decree in Ezra 4 was worded specifically in such a way that would permit its change. That decree was worded so that the king had put into the decree, unless I change my mind. Well, that may answer everything right there. Think about it for a moment. It may be that this problem of the irrevocable laws really never came into play very often, because usually they would put in such language that would say it can be revoked or it can be changed later. That what that would mean is that this problem really only arose when it was a hastily created law. Well, that's certainly the case here. It was certainly the case in Daniel. The hastily created laws may be where this problem really came up. And even today, don't we have some experience with hastily created laws that are seemingly irrevocable? Healthcare, anyone? Some commentaries cite another passage by another extra-biblical source, which I want to talk about a little bit, since if you read any commentaries, you're going to read about this. And it was the writing of someone named Diodorus Siculus, and he wrote about another person named Charidamus, who was executed by Darius III. Okay, and that text, that short little passage, suggests that Darius III could not change what had been decreed. And again, that's extra biblical. Let me read it to you. Charidamus became angry and made free with slurs on the Persian lack of manliness. This offended the king, and as his wrath blinded him to his advantage, he seized Charidamus by the girdle, according to the custom of the Persians, turned him over to the attendants, and ordered him to be put to death. So Charidamus was led away, but as soon as he went to his death, he shouted that the king would soon change his mind and would receive a proper acquittal for this unjust punishment, becoming the witness of the overthrow of the kingdom. Charidamus's prospects had been high, but he missed their fulfillment because of his ill-timed frankness, and he ended his life in this fashion. Once the king's passion had cooled, he promptly regretted his act and reproached himself for having made a serious mistake, but all his royal power was not able to undo what was done. All right, there are two ways to read that last sentence. One way is to say, well, Charidamus had already been killed, so all he's saying is, I can't undo that. I can't bring him back. But the other way to read it is to say, I have sentenced him to death, and my law is irrevocable, and I can't change my mind now. Well, if it's the second view, then that's great extra-biblical evidence for the irrevocability of the laws. Well, which view is it? I've gone back and forth on that, I'll have to tell you, but I think after further study for this lesson, I favor the second view, that in fact that is an extra-biblical example of the irrevocability of the Persian laws. Why? Well, why mention his royal power otherwise? Could anybody have brought Charidamus back from the dead, anybody in Persia at that time? I mean, not just the king, that wasn't what anyone could do, but he specifically mentions his royal power could not do it. Also, the verb tense there suggests that he's making a general comment about the Persian legal system and not a particular comment about something that had happened in the past. And also, the arrest of Charidamus, I think, fits well, because there the law of the custom of the Persians is mentioned. So I think for those three reasons, that is extra-biblical evidence of the irrevocability of the Persian laws. That means we have two examples, Herodotus and then the one I just read to you, two examples. And of course, the best evidence of all, even though historians discount it, but the best evidence of all is Daniel and Esther, and they both tell us about it. So there's four pieces of evidence, two from the Bible itself. The command in verse 22 is curious. The version I read said that every man should bear rule in his own house and that it should be published according to the language of every people. A more accurate translation is that every man should be master in his own household and speak according to the language of his own people. That is, I think the better translation is that the person who lived in the house is being commanded to speak the language of his own people and not speak another language. That seems like an odd decree. What's behind that? Well, I think the most likely reason for that is that the man's language in the home was a sign of his leadership. And if he'd been, for example, speaking his wife's language instead of his language, the king wanted the men to all speak their language. And I think that fits in the context of this edict, which has obviously been given for fear that the women are going to take over in the household. Ironically, and we're starting to get a little bit of the humor coming in here, by accepting Memucan's advice, the king ends up publicizing to the entire known world his embarrassing plight. Afraid that all the women in the empire would hear about what Vashti has done, the king assures that all the women in the empire will hear about what Vashti has done. He dispatches it to every corner of the empire. Also ironic is that Vashti's punishment for not wanting to appear before the king is that you can't appear before the king. But of course, others might say that's why it's appropriate. You won't come when I summon you, you'll never come. Also note that Memucan here wants to be sure that this decree is irrevocable. He mentions it several times. He stresses it in verse 19, can't be altered. And in verse 20, he wants it published everywhere, which would certainly make it very hard for the king to ever go back on it, because everybody now knew about it. So Memucan has said, look, it can't be altered, and we're going to publish it so everybody can see it. Why is Memucan so concerned that this thing never be altered? Well, what if Vashti was the evil, vengeful Amestris? You think Memucan might be a little concerned about his own safety if she later came back into power? I think he wants her permanently taken off the scene, and that's what he got here. And if, in fact, she was pregnant with the future King Artaxerxes, that would also explain why Memucan would not have recommended that she be killed, because he knew that was not going to happen. We've already noted it. Ezra is one of the funniest books in the Bible. It just is. You read through the book of Esther, you're going to be laughing at the book of Esther. It is funny. As one commentary noted, the book's incongruous humor is one of its strange hallmarks. And yes, there is humor in the Bible. And, you know, I've heard people tell me before, well, there's nothing humor. Anybody who says there's no humor in the Bible has just not read the Bible. There's humor in the Bible. But is humor appropriate in a book that describes the near genocide of God's people? Well, the simplest answer is that by the time Esther was written, the threat had passed. Everybody then reading it knew of the happy ending that was going to come. I think another commentary provided a different reason. He wrote, humor, especially the humor of ridicule, which we see here, is a device for diffusing fear. The book teaches us to make fun of the very forces that once threatened and will threaten again our existence, and thereby makes us recognize their triviality as well as their power. God laughs at the pretensions of earthly powers. Psalm 2, verse 4, he that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall have them in derision. Psalm 37, 12 through 13 speaks of God's laughter. The wicked plotteth against the just and gnasheth upon him with his teeth. The Lord shall laugh at him, for he sees that his day is coming. Likewise, Psalm 59, verse 8, but thou, O Lord, shall laugh at them. Thou shalt have all the heathen in derision. Who is writing this book? God, the Holy Spirit. This is inspired text. I think we see in the book of Esther, Psalm 2, 4, Psalm 37, 12 through 13, Psalm 59. This is God laughing at the so-called great King Xerxes. In the context of human fear, divine laughter breaks the tension. It brings us relief. God is going to prevail over the powers that be in this age or that age, in any age. The book of Esther reminds us that relief and deliverance come from God. It reminds us that God's people should always be a confident people. And a confident person is the one who laughs. At the end of chapter 1, where are we? Queen Vashti has left the building, and her exit has prepared the way for someone who's going to replace her. Questions about chapter 1? Chapter 2, verse 1. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her. Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, let there be fair young virgins sought for the king, And let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather together all the fair young virgins unto Shushan the palace, to the house of the women, unto the custody of Hegai the king's chamberlain, keeper of the women. And let their things for purification be given them. And let the maiden which pleaseth the king be queen instead of Vashti. And the thing pleased the king, and he did so. The phrase after these things in verse 1, it doesn't tell us how long after these things. Verse 16 in this chapter will tell us that Esther came before the king in the seventh year of his reign, which would be 4 years after the event in chapter 1, which verse 3 of chapter 1 tells us happened in the third year of his reign. We know from extra-biblical evidence that Xerxes' disastrous Greek campaign happened in between those two events. We know that loss depleted his treasuries. We know that loss discredited him in the eyes of his subjects. He came back with much less power. Herodotus describes the king's life after that defeat as one focused on sensual overindulgence. He had affairs with the wives of some of his generals, which, among other things, eventually led to his assassination in his bedroom in 465 BC. Now, it seems to some from verse 1 that the king regretted his irrevocable decision against Queen Vashti, but that's not what the text says. Again, I think we're reading in a little motivation there. What the text says is that he remembered Vashti. If Vashti was the evil and vengeful Amestris, then he's not remembering her with fondness. In fact, it may be that after all these events, Xerxes is more than ready to have a new queen, particularly now that he's come back from that bad Greek campaign. In any event, the decree had been irrevocable. He's not going to get Vashti back, and so we see here a search for a replacement. On the surface, this search sounds like a beauty contest. But the women involved, it would not have been a pleasant experience at all. They were uprooted from their homes. They were taken to live in the king's harem. A Persian king could have as many women as he wanted, and history tells us about the suffering that caused the women that he wanted, that he brought into his harem to satisfy his own personal desires. Herodotus, in fact, tells us that he would also take 500 young boys every year and have them castrated to serve as eunuchs in his court. So, in fact, there was a lot of suffering going on there, and also with the women that were taken. According to Herodotus, Persian kings found their wives among the noble families and among the families of his close advisors. Maybe that's why those advisors were so eager to see Vashti banished. Maybe they thought they were going to get one of their daughters married off as the next queen. But Plutarch, in fact, tells us that sometimes they took wives from other sources. We see Xerxes doing that here. Xerxes' own mother came from another such source, so we know that the Persian kings did not always take their wives from Persian noble Persian families. Verses 5 through 9. Now in Shushan, the palace, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity which had been carried away with Jeconiah, the king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And he brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. And the maid was fair and beautiful, whom Mordecai, when her father and mother were dead, took for his own daughter. So it came to pass, when the king's commandment and his decree was heard, and when many maidens were gathered together unto Shushan the palace, to the custody of Hegai, that Esther was brought also unto the king's house, to the custody of Hegai, keeper of the women. And the maiden pleased him, and she obtained kindness of him. And he speedily gave her her things for purification, with such things as belonged to her, and seven maidens which were meet to be given her, out of the king's house. And he preferred her and her maids unto the best place of the house of the women. Well, there were 16 Persians mentioned in chapter 1. We're now down to one. Xerxes is the only one that's mentioned here by name. The Jews are mentioned for the first time here in verse 5. And it's interesting that they're mentioned in the third person. They're mentioned in the third person. One commentary suggested that perhaps the inspired author may have been inspired to write this book as kind of a Persian court chronicle, as if written by a non-Jew. It may have been written that way. And that may have been explaining why the Jews are kind of written as third in the third person. It's like it's written from someone outside looking at the Jews from outside. That may also explain some of the other unique features of the book that we've been talking about. The phrase, who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity which had been carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. That phrase has caused a lot of controversy. Why? Well, because the event referenced in verse 6 occurred in 597 B.C., which would mean if Mordecai had been carried away, he'd be 120 years old right now. Well, we know that's not the case. For starters, his cousin Esther would probably not have been the first one to make the notice of the king. The most common solution, though, is to read verse 6 as referring not to Mordecai, not that Mordecai was carried away, but that Kish, his great-grandfather, had been carried away, which makes a lot more sense. That certainly solves the chronological problem. There's a slight problem with that, though, and that is that nearly all the commentaries tell me that that is not the natural interpretation of the Hebrew syntax there. That if you're just reading the Hebrew, it's going to look a whole lot like Mordecai was the one who'd been carried away and not Kish. Another way to address that difficulty, though, is to read verse 6 as applying to Mordecai. Yes, it is applying to Mordecai, but it's saying that he had been carried away in the person of his forefather. That when Kish had been carried away, all of Kish's further descendants had also been carried away, even those later born in captivity, such as Mordecai was. That when Kish was carried away, it carried away his whole family, and in a sense, Mordecai was carried away, even though Mordecai was not yet born. So either that's the correct view, or in fact, it is referring to Kish, that Kish was the one carried away. And in fact, under either of those views, Kish is the actual one who would have been carried away. The fact that Mordecai's family had been carried away at that time, I think it tells us that he was of the upper classes of Jewish society, like Daniel was, for example. So it tells us a little bit about his family. The Babylonian name Mordecai, man of Marduk. Marduk was the chief god of the Babylonian pantheon. If he had a Hebrew name, which he likely did, we're not told what it is. Daniel and his three friends, we know they had both Hebrew and Babylonian names. We were told. We're not told that about Mordecai. Now the text here is telling us something very important. In fact, I would say crucial to understanding Esther. And that is, the text here is clearly associating Mordecai with another Benjamite who also had an ancestor named Kish, and that is King Saul. In fact, King Saul's father was Kish, not his great-grandfather, but his father. So when you see Benjamite, and when you see Kish, and in fact, when you see Shimei, because he was also from Saul's clan, he's the guy that cursed David when he fled the coup led by Absalom. That's not the same Shimei mentioned here, but the name is the same. All of these are cementing Mordecai into the tribe of Benjamin, and they're associating Mordecai with King Saul. That any Jew reading this is going to be thinking, King Saul, King Saul. In other words, Mordecai is associated with King Saul. Why is that so important? We're going to see that answer when we get to Haman. Because we're going to be asking the question, what's behind this controversy between Haman and Mordecai? And the answer is going to have to do with King Saul. We'll get there later. In a text from the last years of Darius I, of the early years of Xerxes, that was discovered in 1904, the text mentions a man named Marduka that's been dug up by archaeologists. Some have said that might be Mordecai. So timing's about right. Marduka, the man of Marduk, that could be an extra-biblical reference to Mordecai. We just don't know for sure. In verse 7, we finally meet her, Esther. Mordecai had adopted his cousin Esther because her parents were dead. And Esther's the only person in this book that we have two names given in the book. Many of the others probably had two names, but we're given the two names here. We know it was common. It was common for Jews to have both a Hebrew name and a Babylonian name. But with Esther, we're given both. Hadassah means myrtle. Esther may be the Persian word for star. It may be the Hebrew transliteration for Ishtar, which was the Babylonian goddess of love and war. We've already mentioned the root Hebrew word there means hidden and or concealed, which is interesting when you think about what happens to Esther in the book. By mentioning both names here, I think it's setting the stage for a conflict in Esther's life. She's a person with two identities, as we're going to see. Which one's going to win out? The Ishtar Esther or the Hadassah Esther? Which one? I think we're seeing that the stage laid for that here. If Mordecai referred to the false god Marduk, and if Esther, her name refers to the false god Ishtar, then perhaps the text once again is asking the question, who is really in charge? Will Mordecai turn to Marduk? Will Esther turn to Ishtar? Or will they both turn to the one true God who is not named in the book of Esther? I think again, we're seeing a subtle question here. Who's really in charge? Well, how many women were brought before the king? Josephus says there were 400. We don't know for sure. The phrase Esther also was taken does certainly suggest she did not have a choice in the matter. The passive voice does not necessarily require that interpretation, but in chapter 2, verse 6, it's the same voice that's used to describe the captives who were carried away from Jerusalem, and we know they certainly went against their will. In fact, the passive voice, it's interesting, it's used a lot in the book of Esther, which I think indicates that, you know, these characters are kind of being moved around, many of them, where they lack control, seemingly, you know, and so Esther is just taken. By the king. There's a little more humor, in fact, a strong note of irony in verse 9. The man who was pleased by Esther and whose favor she won was Haggai, the king's eunuch. One commentary observed, Esther's beauty was so overwhelming, even to a eunuch. Possibly. Some wonder why Esther did not protest eating the unclean food as Daniel did. The text does not tell us. We're not told. One of the other things we're not told. We will see in a moment that Esther was specifically instructed not to disclose her Jewish identity. And I think that would be the answer why she ate the unclean food. And we'll answer in a moment why she was told not to disclose her identity. Verse 10. Esther had not showed her people nor her kindred, for Mordecai had charged her that she should not show it. And Mordecai walked every day before the court of the women's house to know how Esther did and what should become of her. Now when every maid's turn was to come to go into King Ahasuerus, after that she had been 12 months, according to the manner of women, for so were the days of their purifications accomplished, to wit 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with sweet odors and with other things for the purifying of the women. Then thus came every maiden unto the king. Whatsoever she desired was given her to go with her out of the house and of the women unto the king's house. In the evening she went, and on the morrow she returned into the second house of the women, to the custody of Shagaz, the king's chamberlain, which kept the concubines. She came in unto the king no more, except the king delighted in her, and that she was called by name. Well, we're not told why Mordecai told Esther to conceal her identity, even though it certainly would have required her to compromise some things in the law, such as what she was eating. If she had taken the stand Daniel did, for example, everyone would have known that she was Jewish. Daniel, for example, did nothing to conceal his identity. In fact, he proclaimed it to everybody who would listen. Esther's different. Some suggest that Esther would have had no chance of becoming queen if her nationality had been known, perhaps. But does that then mean Mordecai was acting out of ambition? I don't really see that as what we just read here, but again, we're not told his motivation. Perhaps he knew, or perhaps was made to know, by God, that Esther as queen would be in a much better position to help her people when the time came. But is that just a rationalization on his part? We'll overlook this so that she can be in a better position to help? We're not told. Another possibility is that the knowledge of her identity might have proved very dangerous to her personally. We see anti-Semitism in this book. And Haman might not have been the only one who felt that way. And in fact, we're going to see in a moment that Haman's immediate reaction to being insulted by a Jew is to kill all the Jews. So there's a lot of animosity toward the Jews here. So I think Mordecai likely had very good reason to fear for Esther's safety. And I think that is why he told her to conceal her identity, because he feared for her personal safety. Particularly so if the banished Vashti was in fact the evil, vengeful Amestris, who we've already seen had women mutilated who she disliked. What makes me think that's the true answer? Because look at what Mordecai is doing. He's checking on Esther every day. He's concerned about her. He's concerned about her safety. I think that's the reason. Verses 12 through 14 reveal the process by which these girls were presented to the king. Apparently, most of the girls here, the women, would only spend a single night with the king, and then they would move into the house of Shagaz and became a concubine. There was no guarantee the king would ever call them again. which means they would be confined to what one commentary called perpetual widowhood. After one night with the king, most of them would live their lives in seclusion in that harem. I think all of this is being told to us here because the author is showing us that the odds are stacked against Esther. She's just one of many, most of whom would never again come before the king. And I think the inspired text is showing us here the odds are stacked against her. How could such a marginalized person in a hostile world ever make a difference to God, for God? And this book is going to tell us that. How? By a great reversal. A great reversal. And that's our theme. Next week we'll pick up with verse 15. Thank you very much for your attention.